Okay, good evening. Welcome. Thanks for coming. I'm David Kramer, the librarian here at JTS, director of the library, and it is our pleasure, as you know, to sponsor book talks over the course of the year for authors publishing new books. This is an adventure that began now years ago with just faculty books, and this evening it is a faculty book, but it's expanded beyond that as well. So it's our pleasure and privilege to provide the opportunity for authors with new important Jewish works to come and present, and we're glad that you're able to come. This evening, as you know, our translator, but also the author of a very important introduction and editor of the poetry is Ray Shenland, who is a longstanding and much beloved professor here at the Jewish Theological Seminary. I can say that when he was much younger and when I was much younger, I've told you this story before, but I'll repeat it for you folks. I took what I think to this day is one of the few most important classes I ever took here at JTS. It was a course on medieval Hebrew poetry with Ray, and what it enabled me to do for the rest of my life was to have a perspective and begin with an understanding of that poetry in our prayer books, and particularly High Holiday poetry, which is so difficult. So I've always been grateful to you, Ray, for having prepared me for an important part of my religious life, in addition to an appreciation of the art of that poetry. This evening, as you know, the poetry is of Ibn Gabirol. I do have to say, some of you will already know this, but I have to emphasize that you all know how difficult it is to translate poetry. You can translate its sense, or you can produce poetry, but it's very hard to do both. And Ray has, first of all, a dedication, but also a very unique skill would be too minor a word. I'm on the edge of genius to be able to capture both, both to capture the sense of the original and to create a work that is by itself poetry. If you're familiar with any of his earlier volumes which do this, then you'll know exactly what I'm referring to. So you're in for a great treat this evening. As you can see, there are volumes here for sale afterward, but you don't know whether you will want to buy it yet. You will know very shortly. Thanks.
Thank you, David, and thank you for being here. Just to forestall any questions, the reason I have a black eye isn't that anybody poked me in the eye, but that I've recently had retina surgery. But it's okay, I can see fine. It's just I don't look too good. The last time I gave one of these talks, it was about a different bird altogether. This time's bird is the vulture. The last time I spoke about my then new book, The Song of the Distant Dove, which was about the pilgrimage of Judah Halevi. Now, Judah Halevi and Ibn Gabirol are kind of a pair for me, like Hillel and Shammai in rabbinic literature. There were many great poets in their period, which is medieval Spain, but these two stand out as a complementary pair. And as my career has developed over the decades, I found more and more that I was dropping almost everybody else and focusing on what these two guys have that makes them such a comfortable pair. So tonight I'm speaking about a book that I called Vulture in a Cage. Now, Judah Halevi's characteristic bird is the dove, because the dove has many associations in Jewish literature that are appealing to a Jewish reader. You think about the dove, you think about the flood abating in Genesis, you think about the sacrifices brought by people of modest means in the temple. You think about the Jewish people, which are often compared to a dove in rabbinic literature. The dove, gentle, peace-loving, loyal. By contrast, Ibn Gabirol's favorite bird, the one that he keeps referring to and identifies with himself in several places, is an unclean bird of prey. In a painful poem in which he complains to God of his troubles, he says, Re'ena ba'amal avdach v'onyo, v'chi nafsho kemo da'a yikusha. Regard your servant's suffering and misery. His soul is like a vulture in a trap. Elsewhere, he identifies himself with a whole list of unclean birds. Ki'ilu apacha racham ufarso v'hayita ka'ozniat azazel v'damita ka'at midbar v'choso. The whole list of unclean birds from Deuteronomy is included there. As if your nose were that of a bustard vulture or a black vulture. You are like the desert pelican or like a little owl. If he had called himself an eagle, that would have been an unclean bird, but then he would have been laying claim to a certain nobility. He seems to prefer to identify himself with the more discomfiting species, a bird, both a totem, both unexpected, and let's face it, repellent. Ibn Gabirol was the greatest of the coterie of Hebrew poets that flourished in Spain, what they called in those days Al-Andalus, between the 10th and the 13th centuries. This was the time when Hebrew writers were native Arabic speakers and deeply familiar with Arabic literature. They developed Hebrew poetry in a way that was kind of determined by the influence of Arabic poetry, being steeped in this very prestigious high culture of Arabic poetry. They found a way to imitate it in Hebrew, and there was a whole list of great Hebrew poets who followed those patterns. We don't know much specific about Ibn Gabirol's life, next to nothing, in fact. But I'll tell you what we do know. He was born around 1021 in Malaga, which is way in the south of Spain. His parents died when he is young. He complains of being an orphan. He went to Saragossa as a young man in his teens. He found a patron there, a certain Jewish grandee, whose name was Al-Mutawakkil Ibn Hassan, went by the Hebrew name of Yekutiel Ibn Hassan. But Al-Mutawakkil died after only a few years, and he lost his support in Saragossa, and he left for the south, denouncing Saragossa as a faithless city where no one wanted to patronize his poetry. He may have briefly found a patron in Granada. There was a great Jewish grandee named Shmuel Hanagid, or Ismail ibn Aghrala, as he was known in Arabic, who was an older contemporary, very distinguished and powerful political figure. Ibn Gabirol may have gotten some support from him, but he lost favor because he took a potshot at Ibn Gabirol's poetry. It was kind of a foolish thing to do. That's the last we hear of him. He's said to have been buried in Valencia. He suffered from painful ailments, which he complains about in his poetry. He wrote a book on metaphysics in Arabic, and he wrote a book on ethics, also in Arabic. He also made a collection of Arabic proverbs. He died in 1058, which means 1058 minus 1021. What does that make him?
Young,
very young. And he left behind, besides the books that I just mentioned, a huge corpus of Hebrew poetry, both secular and religious, and a reputation for irritability. One of his successors as a Hebrew poet, Moses ibn Ezra, two generations later, writing in the next century, summed up Ibn Gabirol's personality by saying, he was a philosopher by nature and learning, but his irascible soul had power over his rational soul in such a way that he could not control it. He had a demon that he could not restrain. Now, Ibn Ezra couldn't have known Ibn Gabirol personally. Their dates don't overlap. So the impression of the man is either grounded in tradition that Moses ibn Ezra had picked up, or, I think more likely, extrapolated from the poetry, because the poetry is very cranky. Not all, but crankiness is a big one of Ibn Gabirol's modes, which is one reason that it appeals to me so. Let me tell you a little bit about the book, and then I'll tell you a little bit more about Ibn Gabirol's poetry, and then I'll proceed to do some readings, to read some poems, and comment on the themes that they're trying to explicate. This book is not an attempt to be a comprehensive introduction to Ibn Gabirol, nor is it couched as an academic book. It's simply a collection of translations with an introduction. And I haven't attempted to give the reader an overview of the totality of Ibn Gabirol's production. What I wanted to do was to work with the fact that this poet, more than any other of the poets of his age, used poetry to lay out his individual personality, to put his individual personality in front of the reader. This is an age of conventional writing. Nearly all the poets, including my beloved Judah Halevi, and even Shmuel Hanagid, all of the great Hebrew poets, followed very closely the conventions of Arabic poetry, and when they deviated from it, there was usually a specific reason, some particular purpose in mind. But their poetry overall follows certain rules of genre, certain rules of rhetoric, and it all follows very rigidly the rules of poetics and of prosody. This is an age of convention, and Ibn Gabirol stands out as purposely unconventional. His persona is angry and uningratiating. His language is difficult, often obscure, and his vision is often negative. Again, these are generalizations. They don't apply to everything that he wrote. There's also poems in a different vein, and I'll talk about those too. But what I wanted mainly to lay out was what's unique to Ibn Gabirol and not what's conventional. I wanted to make a selection that would highlight his strange character and his contrary poetic persona. He wrote in all the standard genres of the age. I mean, in the period, poetic genres were very strictly determined by convention. There were poetry where you praise someone, panegyric poetry, where you write to celebrate the greatness of a community leader. There's lampooning poetry, invective poetry, where you attack your enemies or your patron's enemies. Poetry was patronized. In other words, a poet got protected by somebody who paid him a salary to write poetry, praising him and lambasting his enemies or his opponents. Those are the two most important, from a point of view of social history, most important. But there's also other genres that are more personal. Poetry of lament for the dead, in other words, not religious poems necessarily, but poems that might be read at a funeral or at a memorial service. Poems of personal friendship, where the poet is not being paid for his poetry, but simply exchanging courtesies with friends. And then there's poetry of entertainment, which includes wine poetry, love poetry. There's also poetry about moral themes, what we might call gnomic poetry, about conventional ideas about life is short, death is certain, it's best not to be too frivolous, best to repent. So another standard, and also nature, poems describing gardens, almost never wild nature, almost never nature in the wild, almost always nature in a carefully cultivated garden, nature that's predictable, nature that's tranquil and relaxing, not storms as much as gentle spring showers, that kind of thing. There's also religious poetry that was meant to be read in the synagogue. These are the main genres that are represented in the period that we're speaking of. I have organized this book not around those genres, but around certain themes that I think enable Ibn Gabirol as an individual to step out more clearly. Ambition is the first select group of poems. Sickly body, sorrowing soul. Patrons, friends, and enemies. Nature, wine, and eros, and devotional poems. The devotional poems are quite different from the worldly poems in that they generally embody that spirit of harmony and clarity that Ibn Gabirol so often avoids in his worldly poetry, almost as if the religious poet were a different writer altogether from the worldly poet. This is a very complicated paradox that I don't really feel like talking about tonight. This is only a reading and lecture. And the topic of why Ibn Gabirol has these two different poetic personae is an interesting one, but I just want to give you a taste of Ibn Gabirol's way of dealing with a number of his favorite topics and maybe instill in you a taste for this unusual Hebrew poet. And I want to start by speaking of Ibn Gabirol as a sweet singer, quite different from the generalizations I made a moment ago. And I'd like to start by reading a secular poem and a religious poem to give you the sense of the sweet singer that he was capable of being. The first one is inspired by looking at a garden. If you have the book, I see a couple of you have the book. It's on page 212. But you know what? Why don't you treat yourselves by letting me read it to you? Pretend it's bedtime. if I see anybody actually fall asleep, I'm going to hurl this at them. But I think I'll read one or two in Hebrew just so you get the feel of them, right? I don't want to read them all in Hebrew because it will take up all of our time. Katav setav bidyo metarav uvir vivav uv'eit berakav ha-me'irim v'chaf avav mikhtav ale gan mitachelet v'argaman lo nitkenu chahem l'choshev b'machshavav lachen be'et chameda adama p'nei shachak rakma ale v'adei arugot k'chochavav. Hear all the vavs inside the poem, not just at the ends of the lines, but also worked into it, woven into it. That's part of the imagery, too. Winter wrote, with rains and showers for ink, with lightning for a pen, and a hand of cloud, a letter on the ground, in blue and violet, a work no artisan could match with all his skill. So when the earth was longing for the sky, she wove upon her flower beds something like the stars. Well, that's really sweet in many ways. The heavens write a love letter to the earth. It sends rain, which is the ink. It uses a cloud for its hand, and so forth. Lightning is the pen. The lightning is not dangerous or violent. The lightning is fructifying. This is all part of winter, writing the love letter on the ground, and the love letter appears in the form of flowers and grass. The earth, too, longs to reply to the sky. The earth wants to say something back, wants to send back a love message. So it weaves on the beds of flowers something like the stars. In other words, the flowers are, as it were, reflections of the stars. The stars and the flowers, heaven and earth, in absolutely perfect harmony with each other. This is what I mean by harmonious. There's a symmetry in the rhetoric of this poem. Hundreds of poets have written thousands of lines of poetry describing gardens. This is an outstanding way of depicting the perfect symmetry between heaven and earth. As a parallel religious poem, let me read to you this one. Shalosha no sedu yahad la'inai, yisimun zichrecha tamid lefanai. L'shamecha ani azkir shemecha, v'hem adai la'idai ne'emanai. Mekom shifti, yorer machashavti, berak o ezkera roka adanai. Hagig libi, behabiti bekirbi, bechol eit, barachi nafshi adonai. Now, if you know the Book of Psalms by heart, which people used to do in those days, but even if you don't know it by heart, even if you're a regular worshiper in a traditional synagogue, the phrase Barachi Nafshi Et Adonai lies right at hand. Oh, my soul, bless the Lord, which is a quotation from Psalm 104. But it also appears in the liturgy repeatedly. The knowledgeable reader, the reader who's been attentive to how this poem is going, can almost anticipate that it's going to end with those words. By the time all those E's, Hagig Libi, Bahabiti, Bikirbi, Bechol Eit Barachi Nafshi, the Barachi Nafshi Adonai flows quite naturally from Ibn Gabirol's own writing, almost to the point that you could anticipate it is. And here's what the meaning is. Three things there are, together in my eye, that keep the thought of you forever nigh. I think about your great and holy name whenever I look up and see the sky. My thoughts are roused to know how I was made, seeing the earth's expanse where I abide, the musings of my mind when I look inside, at all times, O my soul, bless Adonai. Well, you could spend a good half hour analyzing the details of this poem, but I only want to touch on it lightly because to me this shows in the religious sphere, this also gives you an idea of that perfect harmony between the outside world, the world of nature, the world of the larger world, and the inner world. He seems to contemplate the sky in which he sees God's name written. He contemplates, moving in closer, he contemplates the earth around him, the earth's expanse where I abide. And then finally, moving inward, sees how the mind of man works, the heart of man, the soul of man. And it is this contemplation inward that leads to the spontaneous emergence of the expression of praise, O my soul, bless Adonai. Ibn Gabirol has other religious poems in which he meditates on the meaning of prayer, in which he kind of interprets prayer as a spontaneous overflow of the soul in the direction of God. And that's grounded in a certain philosophical point of view, that the soul of man is, in fact, emanated from a divine source and spends its lifetime trapped inside you, trapped inside me, yearning to return to its source. And when we pray spontaneously, that is the soul's motion upward and outward. It's the soul's natural motion, which is ordinarily impeded by material things. Anyway, I think you see in this poem a kind of a parallel symmetry between the inner world, the world inside man, and the transcendent world of God, an attempt to bring those two together. So far, we have nothing really very dark or depressing, quite the contrary. I wanted to start you off with a feeling of a poet who's capable of has it in him to feel and to project the lovely vision. But I need to turn to the darker Ibn Gabirol, and we're going to do that with a nature poem. This is a longer one, so I'm not going to bother reading it in Hebrew, but there are many features of this poem that are perfectly standard in descriptions of nature, descriptions of gardens, a favorite theme for Arabic poets and for Hebrew poets. And I guess I will read the whole thing. Jasper-colored lightning, send a cloud as wet nurse to the myrtle garden. Tend the flower bed and bind that cloud so that it can't get free. Flash, lightning, toward that myrtle bush. She stands before you, bowed and dripping. The cloud refused to move along until it satisfied the garden's thirsty soul. My heart observed a miracle of God, the garden laughing as the cloud wept, sprinkling droplets with an eager hand, as Aaron used to sprinkle blood upon the altar, tattooing the garden with her buds, inscribing colored patches, red and white. The flower field burned myrrh as incense to the cloud, which quickly burst and poured. Whoever saw its plants exclaimed, "It's covered," but it wasn't, with sickly blight and fever red. If only, friends, you saw my soul, your concubine, moaning amid the shade of all the fruit trees. If you should see me die of sorrows born, cover up my bones with the finest vines. Now we can stop there. So we have here some very conventional motifs. And once again, the rain, the lightning, they're all domesticated. Come rain, come lightning. Not violently, but fructifying to the ground, and the ground responds. But look at some of the images that he throws in here that no other medieval poet would have ever dreamt of doing. Sprinkling droplets with an eager hand, as Aaron used to sprinkle blood upon the altar. We're all ready for something like, as a girl sprinkles tears as she walks lamenting her lost love, or, you know, as somebody drips water from a watering can on the flower beds. We're looking for gentle domestic images. What is his image? As Aaron used to sprinkle blood upon the altar. That's not a beautiful image. It's a yucky image. And nobody ever thought of using such an image for describing rain. Tattooing the garden with her buds. Tattooing, you know, I know tattooing is very fashionable nowadays, but the Bible lets us have what for? No tattooing. That's one of those prohibited things. It's covered, but it wasn't. He wants to say the flowers are greenish and reddish. But instead of saying that they're greenish and reddish, he says they're covered with sickly blight and fever red, yerakon, vidaleket, the names of two diseases. He's taking his imagery from a world that's exactly contrary to the feeling that he wants you to have, but maybe he doesn't want you to have that feeling. Maybe it looks as if he's trying to trap you into enjoying a poem, and then he turns around and hits you with the unpleasant thoughts that might be aroused by the idea of making images, making similes. And you wonder, what is going through his mind? Why does he want us to see the seamy side? that isn't even there. It's only there in his imagination. Why is he putting this dark construction? Well, it's a very small example of what he's capable of doing, but he goes at this on a very big scale in two poems that I'm not going to read to you, but that it's worth reading the book in order to encounter. But I don't want to read them because they're long and they're exceedingly difficult. But he has a poem in celebration of a bowl of flowers. It begins with the words, Kra Hatzir, Ale Achi Shlomot. He describes a bowl of flowers, such as a bowl of flowers has never been described before or since. The flowers are young boys whose fathers have slapped their cheeks, and so their cheeks are red from being slapped. Or they're young girls whose husbands have abused them, or there are all kinds of terrible things. That there's one negative image follows after another, and they raise questions. When you look at these flowers, you think that you're studying Masechet Yevamot. This is weird. I don't know how many of you have ever studied Masechet Yevamot, but one of the things I studied when I was a student at JTS was exactly Masechet Yevamot with David Halivni Weiss, and I didn't understand a thing from the beginning of the semester to the end. He is trying to tell you that you look at these flowers and you find it bewildering. You find it confusing. It's like the relations, like marital relations, forbidden degrees of marriage. A man and his mother-in-law's sister, that kind of thing. I mean, complicated, unfathomable tangles of marital relations. These are embarrassing flowers. They're flowers that make you blush. They're sexual flowers, too. They're virgins wearing diaphanous veils. I mean, they're flowers that you might see in nightmare. And then another poem that I'm not going to read to you, Hallo Etzdach, where he describes his ailment. This is Janice's favorite. Where he describes his skin disease and the boils and his and how they torment him, the pain that he's in and how they burn. And he compares them to all kinds of things, including biblical characters that you've never heard of. You don't understand why he's picking these particular biblical characters for comparison. There's a bizarre imagination going on there. He is capable of pushing this very far, is what I'm trying, this dark vision very far. On the other hand, he's capable of presenting himself as a brash, ambitious, and hopeful youngster. This is a very famous epigram written in his teens. Ani hasar v'hashir li le'eved, ani chinor l'chol sharim v'nognim, v'shiri ka'atarot l'malachim, u'migba'ot p'rashei hasganim, V'hineni v'shesh esrei shenotai, v'libi van kelev ben hashemonim. A prince am I, and poems are my subjects. A lyre am I, for bards and singers all. My songs are coronets for kings, and turbans for the heads of courtiers. I've only 16 years, not one day more, but wisdom like a man who's lived fourscore. By the way, that second line you did hear right, Ani chinor l'chol sharim v'nognim, he was the one who said it first, not Judah Halevi. Ani chinor l'shirai, in Judah Halevi's famous poem, Tzion Halotish Ali, pirated from Ibn Gabiro. Now you know. It will spoil your Tisha B'Av service next year to know that. Here's another one in that spirit. Don't be amazed at one who burned to scale the heights of wisdom and who reached his goal. He is a soul encompassing the body. He is a sphere encompassing the all. Well, that's a claim. That is some claim. Wisdom is the object of a quest that determines a great deal of the poetry and a great deal of both of the boasting poetry and of the frustration poetry. And the most important of it has to do not with the ailments and not with the gardens. It has to do with this quest for wisdom. It's yielding to him, as he boasts in this poem, this epigram, or it's resisting, which is one of the main themes of his poems of complaint. And these poems are youthful efforts. I mean, he makes a point of stressing his age in many of the poems, 16, 17, 18. There are boasts that are not quite as charming as the one that I read just now. but they have that dark spirit. Here's a longer and more brooding poetry of ambition. It's couched, as many of his poems are, as a dialogue. Another person begins the dialogue by addressing him, and most of the poem is his reply. So the first speaker says, "Quit your ifs and stop your maybes. Listen to me well. Don't go after aspirations. Be aware that time is niggardly." That's the world berating me, jealous of my poetry, instructing me, and showing me the minds of men who mock me. I used to laugh at the sons of days, but today they laugh at me. Why should I fear day's daughters? My words begot those daughters. Yes, indeed, I am the soul. The human race is one of my effects. Yes, indeed, I am the sphere. The stars are constellations set inside me. The cosmos is my chariot. My robe's folds fill it. My heart is ignorant of evil. No wickedness resides inside my tents. I don't get sad, and if I do, it's only wisdom makes me wail. I don't make merry, and if I do, it's mainly when I find a friend. I have a furnace in my heart, in my kidneys, in my liver. It burns, as God can testify, till I bestow upon a friend my gift. My eye and purse are never niggardly. As for my foe, I trample him, turn him into dirt beneath my feet, make him a target for my verbal darts, fuel for my hissing coals. Well, there is my angry friend at the end of the poem. But look at the tangle of moods that he takes you through. The world berates him for his ifs and his maybes. I guess that summarizes his work as a philosopher. He's a man who weighs and judges and is constantly hesitating between possibilities. The world berates him and says, don't go after these aspirations. Time will never give you what you want. Time is niggardly. It's not generous. It won't help you. And he says, that's the world berating me. The world doesn't want me to get ahead. The world is jealous of my poetry. The world shows me that people mock me. Things were better once before. But I'm not afraid of day's daughters. You were wondering what day's daughters means. Day's is a word that represents time, and time is a word that represents something that we might call the vicissitudes of life. Time is everything that changes, everything mutable, everything that makes friends go away, that makes people die, that makes us not be able to fulfill our ambitions. The daughters of time, the daughters of days, are the individual events that make up our lives. And he tries to raise himself above that with this outrageous boast, similar to what we read in the epigram at first. Why should I fear day's daughters? My words begot those daughters. And I am the source here. I am not subject to any fate. My ambition is so powerful that I control fate. It's whistling in the dark, of course, but it's really masterful whistling in the dark. I am the sphere. The stars are constellations set inside me. And I'm loyal to my friends, but I will crush my enemies. So that's kind of a manifesto. I want to read you now a selection that will illustrate the quest for wisdom more directly. This is it's rather longer than the other ones, but it gives him a chance to perform. By reading it, I give him a chance to perform for you in his most accomplished mode. And it begins with a boast. I am the man who cinched his belt, not to undo it until his vow is fulfilled, whose heart turns back in horror from his heart, whose soul disdains to dwell inside his flesh, who made his choice for wisdom as a boy, though time refined him 7 times in his retort, destroying everything he built, uprooting everything he planted, breaking down his fences. A man who would attain, but trouble blazes, days, time's minions block him. The utmost heights of wisdom and of learning probe the deepest treasures of the intellect. But know that no one masters mysteries until he has consumed his very flesh. Just yesterday I bought a little wisdom. Time was there at dawn to get the price. Yet still you see me riding after wisdom, though time would never saddle up his mule. My heart will never flag because of time. It will fulfill its vow. It will not fail. And yet, my friends, the thing I feared befell. Nothing befalls a man but what he fears. One night I slept beneath a cloudless sky, under a clear moon, pure and innocent, that guided me along the paths of wisdom, and taught me with its light, teaching as we went. I was in fear of trouble, anxious like a father for his son about its light. A wind sent sails of cloud against the moon, and spread its veil against its face, as if it wished just then to get a stream of rain, and leaned against the cloud to make it flow. The heavens dressed in black, the moon seemed dead, buried by the clouds, while over it thick clouds of heaven wept, as Aram once lamented Beor's son. The night put on black chainmail, thunder pierced it with a lightning lance, and then the lightning fluttered through the sky as if to mock its fate, for like a bat, the darkness spread its wings, and when they saw its flash, the crows of darkness fled. God had shut up my thoughts and blocked my heart on every side from its desire. My heart was bound in thick cloud cords of darkness, but it rose raging like a warrior from captivity. Whenever I have hopes, my friends, and look for moonlight, darkness ruins it, as if the clouds for jealousy are bent on keeping it away from me. But when its face appears, I gaze, delighted as a servant in his master's grace. When a man fights, his lance will break. When he runs, his steps will fail. And trouble often overtakes a man, although he makes his home among the stars. Well, that's a complicated poem, maybe too much for one reading, but let me just walk you through the chief parts of it and give you an idea of where he's headed with this. He begins by describing his quest for wisdom as a kind of a war, a battle. He goes out to battle, girding up his loins, and yet he knows that it's an impossible battle. He knows that fate will never let him really penetrate to the inmost depths of wisdom. He knows that there's no attaining wisdom without self-destruction. This is a key line. Know that no one masters mysteries until he has consumed his very flesh. You've got to hear it in Hebrew to really get the feel of it. V'da ki lo yigale ad yichale tzufune ta'alumot ish she'ero. It's a very tangled sentence. When I teach this poem in Hebrew, I write the line on the blackboard and number the words out of order to show the correct ordering of them. You would never get the meaning of that in one reading. You have to brood on it a little while to get the way the words fall together. But he's trying to imitate with a syntax the notion that the quest for wisdom is an impossible quest, and even self-destructive. Even a person has to use himself up in order to achieve any real wisdom. And then, having enunciated this truth as a kind of a generalization, he then moves into a different mode altogether, into a kind of a narrative, descriptive mode, where he describes a night vision, where he sees the moon, the moon seems to be teaching him as his guide, yet he's fearful that the moon can't stay bright forever, and indeed a cloud comes along, and a storm begins, lightning and thunder and clouds. The cloud leans against the moon in order to pour its rain, and the night puts on black chainmail, but there's thunder and lightning that bright up the sky briefly. the lightning flutters through the sky as if to mock its fate, the night's fate, because the darkness spreads its wings and flies like crows or like bats. And he learns from this that when the heart is blocked, when the heart feels that it's walking in darkness, nevertheless, a moment can come when there's a flash, when the intellect receives a flash, and suddenly wisdom reveals itself for a brief moment, and then the darkness fills in again. And you learn from experience not to despair over that, not to despair over the darkness, but to wait patiently for the flash of the lightning that only appears for an instant, but that instant is an instant of revelation. And he ends by just a series of maxims. When a man fights, his lance will break. When he runs, his steps will fall. Trouble often overtakes a man, though he make his home among the stars. But he is a man who does make his home among the stars, as he says repeatedly that his quest for wisdom elevates him and places him among the constellations. Anyway, it's a very complicated and poem that lends itself to lengthy analysis, but that gives you the gist of it. I think you ought to hear Ibn Gabiro in his whiny mode. I guess I should have said that what mode was that poem in that we just read? Well, it kind of vacillates between self-confidence, brief entertaining of loss, and then a wiser view. Just because the struggle is hard doesn't mean you have to give it up, but wisdom does yield from time to time. So there's a complicated set of feelings about this quest for wisdom. But I'm going to read you something that's more consistently whinier, because I feel you need that at this point. My song has been displaced by sorrow. My joy is crowded out by sighs. Whenever I see laughter, my heart weeps, because my life is being plucked away from me. You're just 16, my friend. Is this the time to weep and mourn about the day of gathering? At your age, better to be swept away by one with sun-drenched, rosy cheeks. My heart has governed me since boyhood, subordinated all my appetites. It made its choice for wisdom and for learning, made my appetites its anger's object. But what's the good of anger? Just be still and hope, for every ailment has a cure. What use is there in weeping over hardships? What value has the tear downpoured? What good is hope, and how long must I wait? The day goes on, the term has not been reached. Before the balm of Gilead arrives, a man will die whose soul it is that's sick. At 16, that's precocious. What is this boy's trouble? He's not even a man yet. What is his problem? The quest for wisdom is so difficult? I don't know. He seems to read himself out of the pleasures of youth. He seems to isolate himself from friends, or to be isolated from friends. He imagines an interlocutor, but one of the saddest things about Ibn Gabirol's poetry is that so much of it complains that he doesn't have a friend. He so often complains he's alone. He's an orphan. He's friendless. He has no supporters, no patrons, nobody to pour out his heart to. And yet, so many of his poems are couched as dialogues with imaginary friends, as if he has to make up friends in order to have somebody to talk to. Now, what was he really like as a human being? I do not know. I'm not saying he was really like this. There's no way of knowing what he was really like. The question is, why does he want to project this kind of image of himself? Why is he telling us that this is how he is? And as a boy, and the poem is dated, he tells us that he's 16 years old. Not the only one that comes from that early period. But let's look at the bright side. Here is another way of depicting the quest for wisdom. I think you'll find it more congenial. I gazed into the upper world, beheld her high abodes, sped aloft until I reached her inmost place. I was wretched, sick at heart. She sang to me, promised she would take me in and set me by her side. She brought me to a chamber, marble paved and set with crystals. She spread for me her blue and scarlet bedding, drew me lovingly toward her rivers of delight, storehouse of her bread and water and her finest oils. I ate her luscious food till I was full. She lifted me into the garden of her Sharon roses. My soul imagined it would stay inside her pleasure chamber, thought her hardships now were over, her sorrows done. And then we go into other things. We're not going to read the rest of it now. But I wanted to give you this erotic vision of the quest for wisdom, because that's a little different from what we had before. We had vision. We had the quest for wisdom as a battle, girding up loins, going out and getting your sword all bloody. And here we have it as an erotic conquest, or rather an invitation, an erotic invitation from wisdom itself. It's a poem that hasn't gotten much attention in the secondary literature, but it deserves attention. Let's conclude with a couple of his religious poetry, of his religious poems. This is one that you probably know, because many modern prayer books have incorporated it as part of the morning service. At dawn I come to you, my rock, my strength. I offer you my dawn and evening prayers. Before your majesty I stand in fear, because your eye observes my secret thoughts. What is there that man's mind and mouth can make? What power is there in my body's breath? And yet the songs of man delight you. Therefore I shall praise you while God's breath remains in me. There you have that sense of harmony, disturbed briefly and then restored. The man comes to face God in the morning and is struck by the majesty of God's presence, fears God's observant eye penetrating into his mind, and feels himself to be helpless. And a quite beautiful line in Hebrew, Maze asher yuchal halev halashon lasot. I tried to imitate the L's with M's. What is there that man's mind and mouth can make? What power is there in my body's breath? The man feels himself to be incapable of doing anything that will really of saying anything that will impress God, who already sees into him. What room is there for speech? And yet, the songs of man delight you. There's a confidence that isn't really justified by any logic here. There's no attempt to prove it or to demonstrate it. There's only a poetic assertion. And yet the songs of man delight you, and therefore I shall praise you while God's breath remains in me. Another attempt to deal with this disparity between the transcendence of God and man's desire to speak to him. With lowly spirit, lowered knee and head, in fear I come, I offer you my dread. But facing you, I know that I've no more worth than any little worm that crawls the earth. O fullness of the world, infinity, what praise can come, if any can, from me? Your splendor is not contained by the hosts on high, and how much less capacity have I? Infinite you, and infinite your ways, therefore the soul expands to sing your praise. So once again, the approach to God is governed by a very conventional statement, I come to you in humility. But it's as if breaking through the cliché, I come to you in humility, is an actual realization of what it means to be humble before God, who is the fullness of the earth, the infinity, and not contained by anything, even by the angels, even by the heavens. My inability to praise God in his transcendence is an unbridgeable gap that makes it impossible. There's no possibility of crossing over it. And yet, there's kind of a paradoxical ending. Infinite you and infinite your ways, therefore the soul expands to sing your praise. probably based on the notion that I mentioned to you before, that the soul is a bit of God. The soul is, as being emanated from God and being trapped, prisoned in the body, the soul has the capability of expanding. So I may be nothing, I may be small, I may be a little worm that crawls the earth, but I have a bit of God inside me anyway. And since God overflows the heavens, he obviously overflows my body. My uttering of prayer, my uttering of the poem, is again that overflow of the infinite soul inside me that unites me with God. Doesn't it make you want to throw your body out and forget about material life? That's the purpose. If you entertain that feeling for even half an instant, then Ibn Gabirol has done what he wanted you to do. He wants you to feel that your body is meaningless and worthless. He's not part of this robust rabbinic notion that there's room for the body, room for the soul, everything in balance. As a Neoplatonist, he feels that the body is matter. It's potentially the source of evil. It's dangerous. The body represents the limitation on the soul fulfilling its ambition. And you feel that the soul's ambition to rise and to rejoin itself with a transcendent God is the same as the ambition that Ibn Gabirol describes in his personal poetry. That even when he doesn't say it explicitly, his ambition isn't just to be recognized, although he often talks about that. He often complains about the world not acknowledging his superiority. You feel that apart from that less important kind of ambition, the ambition here is to rise above humanity itself and to become pure, disembodied spirit. And the inability to do that in this world may be what leads him to the negative vision that in his warped and distorted flower images, flower poetry. I'm going to end with the last poem in the book, just because it's a very nice one. Could call it an evening poem. Shemesh kechatan ya'ateh sut or mehodecha ne'etzal v'lo ne'edar. Lamad lesove vel pa'at marav, mishtachave el his'acha ne'edar. Miyom avadcha sar, v'chein eved yehdar p'nei rabo, yihi ne'edar. Hu yom biyom mishtachave lach gam at ma'ateh alav me'il hadar. The sun puts on a bridegroom's suit of light, a never-failing light that shines from you. Each evening he turns to face the west and bows toward your throne, O Mighty One. Serving you has made him powerful, as courtiers gain honor, honoring their lords. Each day he bows before you when he sets, and you in turn enwrap him in a robe of splendor. There you have your symmetry again. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You'll take questions?
Sure, gladly.
So thank you. It was real nice. I very much liked your book on Halevi.
Thank you.
Greatly. This poet, the Gabirol seems much more, I'm not sure the word, mysterious, unknown for sure. I wanted to ask you if there were any opposites. I mean, first of all, is there any syncretism in this poetry? Because he's obviously, really knowledgeable about the Muslim tradition, the Arab tradition. And it seems like a time when people were mixing.
Mm-hmm.
And in his own mysteriousness, like who was he, this poet of love, this poet of all kinds of problematic concerns about what others think of him. What were your, I've read your stuff for a long time. What were your insights about who he actually is? I know it's not a fair question, but I'm not trying to be mysterious.
No, I share your frustration. It's hard to know who he is because his poetry is full of contradictions. But I think that there are some common themes that you can tease out of it. And one of them is that, to start with, he really is a product of a very large culture that embraces not just Judaism, but the philosophical currents that were current in the Arab world. And all of these poets were conversant with Arabic and knew the Arabic literary traditions, but few of them, as much as he, were so steeped in the philosophical tradition. There have been those who have said that he was also steeped in the Sufi tradition. I have devoted a good deal of time to trying to find the Sufi elements in Ibn Gabirol's poetry, and I really can't convince myself that they're present, at least not the influence of Sufi poetry. I haven't been able to find that, although I've gone looking for it systematically. Nevertheless, he's clearly trying to bring together ideas from the larger culture, and especially the philosophical tradition. Now, he's not the only one who's at home in the philosophical tradition, but if you take, say, Saadia Gaon, who also wrote poetry, but not of this kind. Saadia is known mainly as a theologian, a halachic expert. And Saadia's Islamic world, the mental world, the Islamic mental world that determines Saadia's writing isn't philosophy as much as it is Islamic theology, and the attempts to harmonize, to find a rational way of reading the Quran, but not the classic philosophical themes that come into Islam from Aristotle and from Neoplatonism. Ibn Gabirol was so much of a philosopher that when he wrote his philosophical text, he didn't bother even referring to Judaism. He didn't bother even quoting the Bible once, so that his philosophical work passed as the work of a Muslim philosopher for centuries until its identity was discovered in the 19th century. So if that's what you meant by syncretism, he's a classic example of it. He belonged to a kind of an international class of intellectuals that the Arabs called filosofs. You can recognize the Greek word philosopher in the Arabic word filosof, right? These are people who studied Greek philosophy and Greek mathematics and Greek medicine. They knew these works because they were translated from Greek into Syriac and from Syriac into Arabic. And there was a whole undercurrent of this going on throughout the Islamic world of people who were at home in that, in the Greek philosophical and scientific tradition. And these people could meet and discuss even matters of religion, though they may have belonged to different religions. I mean, we think of the Islamic world as so fanatical, and in some ways it was, but there was room in the great urban centers, in Baghdad particularly, there was room for intercommunal discussion of common philosophical and scientific ideas. And Ibn Gabirol definitely belonged to that kind of thinker. He was clearly linked to the Jewish world, and he wrote poetry in the Jewish vein. He contributed to the liturgy. I have no doubt that he waited 6 hours between meat and milk, or whatever they did in the Middle Ages. In his mind, he was quite independent of the rabbinic tradition, which he knew inside out. I can prove that he knew the rabbinic tradition because he wrote a poem on the 613 mitzvot. So you've got to be at home in at least the religious language to do a thing like that. But his poetry reflects this. It's so diverse, partly because it's very much linked to his religious poetry is very much part of the Jewish tradition. Some of these poems that I read are found in prayer books, if not your own, in somebody's. And secular poetry isn't just part of the Islamic poetry tradition. That's the point I'm trying to make. Like all the poets, he drew on the Arabic literary tradition, but he worked it out in his own way. There is no Arabic poet who resembles Ibn Gabirol, or at least his partner among the Arabic poets hasn't been discovered. This quest for wisdom theme, this theme of the body and the soul that is so pervasive, it's part of the Arabic philosophical tradition, not of the literary tradition. I hope that moves a little bit in the direction of answering your question. I've talked you all into a stupor. Okay. Ilana.
Your work, but I wonder if you know anything about the history of transmission of his poetry, manuscripts.
We're not as well informed about how the poetry, about the textual tradition is not as ample for him as it is for Judah Halevi, say. It's certain that there was a compilation of his poetry done in the Middle Ages. Fragments of it have been discovered. but we don't have any large corpus from the Middle Ages. What we have is individual poems. In the Geniza, we have groups of pages, like several pages of poems by Ibn Gabirol or by various poets, including Ibn Gabirol. We at JTS have, I think, we have the largest fragment from the Geniza of Ibn Gabirol's poetry. It's about 20 leaves, I think, of poems by Ibn Gabirol. Must come from a medieval compilation devoted exclusively to Ibn Gabirol. But that's the biggest that we have. The first real collection of Ibn Gabirol that we have is from a very famous manuscript called Shokan 37 that was copied in Turkey by a Sephardic copyist in the 17th century. And that was brought from Spain, based on a forlaga that was brought from Spain and then copied in Turkey. And it was nearly lost, but it was discovered in the 19th century. And is now found in Jerusalem in the Shokan Institute, which, though it belongs to the Jewish Theological Seminary, makes it impossible for anyone to look at this manuscript. I'm not supposed to talk about it, but I have seen, it was before you were a librarian, so I can talk about it. I actually saw a microfilm of it. I don't think I was supposed to. It was very weird. I don't know. The Shokan family owns the manuscript. We don't. And they guard it jealously, and they don't want anybody to actually see it unless they're personally authorized. Chaim Shirman was authorized, and the Diwan of Ibn Gabirol that we have, that Shirman edited together with his teacher, Chaim Brody, that's based on Shokan 37. But at the same time, Dov Yardain was working on a commentary on Ibn Gabirol, and he could not get the Shokan family for love or money to get him, let him look at the manuscript. So these two books appeared at the same time, but one is based on this manuscript and one isn't. If there is, I don't know about it. I mean, I've stopped looking for it long ago, but somebody may have followed it up. At the time that I was interested in this topic, there was no access to it. It's not such a terrible loss because Shirman transcribed, you know, he used it in his edition. But, you know, and Shirman was a very great and very reliable scholar, but with the Geniza, even the great and reliable scholar, you need to take a second look because the letters are very unclear. The writing of Shokan 37 is particularly slovenly. And many times letters are subject to, you can read a dalet as a resh or a kaf as a bet. You know, there's a million possibilities for mistakes. So it always pays to look twice.
And it's all vocalized?
Shokan 37, no, I don't think it's vocalized. If I remember correctly, it's not. Some manuscripts are. The Geniza manuscript that we have is partly vocalized, if I remember correctly.
Is his Neoplatonism, do we move? Infer that out of his text, or does he actually refer to particular Neoplatonist Plotinus?
Well, he actually quotes Plotinus in one place, not by name. He doesn't cite him by name, but the quotation is easily identified. It's a famous passage about how I raised myself above the universe and looked down as if everything was a small something or other in my hands, and so forth. It's a confessional passage in Plotinus that he actually quotes verbatim in Arabic, of course, in the book. And it's a quotation that's found in a number of medieval texts. He may not have gotten it directly from Plotinus. I mean, I don't think Plotinus's works existed as such in the Middle Ages, but they were used and copied into other books. So he had access to it through something called the Philosophia of Empedocles. I mean, none of these are correctly attributed in the Middle Ages.
Yeah. There are volumes for sale at $18 if you've got exact change or if somebody before you had exact change. Otherwise, it might be $20. Please come back next week. We actually, a week from tonight, have a talk. Mel Skolt will be discussing the publication of the next volume of his selected entries from Mordechai Kaplan's diaries, these relating to the years leading up to and including the Second World War. So it ought to be very, very interesting. Thank you so much for coming.